Hello and welcome to the Free Writers Workshop, finding your audience through social networking, social media, podcasting, and ebooks. I'm Brian Rathbone. I'm a writer, podcaster, publisher, and I'm also one of the hosts of PatioRacket.com, which we'll talk a little bit more about. But hello to all our listeners on the internet. If you'd like more information about me, go to BrianRathbone.com, and if you'd like to find out about Patio Racket, please go to PatioRacket.com. And I'd also like to thank our host today, Fireside Books and Gifts. And if you'd like to visit Fireside Books and Gifts, they're in Forest City or at FiresideBooksandGifts.com. First, I'd kind of like to just start off by telling you a little bit about where I started and where I am today so that you kind of have an idea of the process that I went through, and then we can kind of move forward into some of the more specifics of audience building and social media and podcasting. In 2005, I got the opportunity to finally write the books that had been rolling around in my head for a number of years, and I was a fantasy fan for a long time, and I always wanted to write fantasy. I think a lot of fantasy readers and sci-fi readers and readers in general aspire to be writers. And I think that's one of the reasons that finding a community of writers is also finding a community of readers. So when I first put out my story, I wanted to find a publisher, a traditional publisher, get a book deal, get an agent, take the world by storm, hit the New York Times bestseller list, make a whole lot of money, and then just lay around the house and write books. That didn't happen. I collected a couple of small rejection slips that really got me thinking about what was I doing, how was I doing it, and was I doing it well? And what I realized is, for the most part, I wasn't doing it well. I'd written good books. I was very happy with my books, but I was failing to think in terms of business. I was thinking with my heart and not with my head, because every one of these books that's on the shelves here cost money to print, and there's only so much room on those shelves. So when you get a book deal, the publisher is taking a great deal of risk based on will your book sell or not. And a great deal of that risk is actually in the bookstore itself, where physical inventory has been printed, taken to a distributor, distributed out to the bookstores, put on the shelf, and then it has a certain amount of time until it's going to come off that shelf and not be sold. And in many cases, that's a return, and the publisher's not going to get paid for that returned book, and that book is not going to go back to the publisher and then get turned around and sent to another store. Those books are generally destroyed. So there's great financial risk in any publisher that's going to put your book into distribution and get you on the bookshelves. So when I realized that, I started to also recognize that I didn't present a very good business case to an agent or a publisher, because nobody knew who I was. I didn't have an audience. I didn't have anybody out there clamoring for my next book. Therefore, it was an extremely big risk for a publisher to say, yeah, I'm going to buy your book. I'm going to put resources behind editing it, laying it out, getting cover art made, running a press run, putting it into distribution, and taking all of that risk. You'd have to be a really good writer. And my writing's not that great, but who knows? You know, we all live and learn and get better, but I didn't hook somebody with that first line, and that was part of what I've learned as well, is that when you're querying someone, you need to put your best foot forward. You need to find out what it is that makes a successful query, what agents and publishers are looking for in that query, and what they're specifically not looking for. I think one of the things they're not looking for is someone who has unrealistic expectations. I think that was mistake number one for me, was that just because I had finished three books that I thought were very good, I thought any agent or any publisher was going to hop at the chance to pick up that material and put it out to the world. What I've now come to realize is that the agent-publisher system is built for rejection, which means they reject a lot more material than they accept. So you're automatically going into a system where somebody picks up your material and is looking for reasons to discard it. And if you give them one, they'll take you up on it. So you really have to get to a point where you're presenting a business case and your work in a way that someone will automatically see it and say, that's a good deal. And for me, it was going to take some work to get there. Now, I could have gone a more traditional route, which is to write short stories, submit them to paying markets, develop some qualifying sales. Say, for me as a science fiction and fantasy writer, I could have become a qualified member of the SFWA, the Science Fiction Writers and Fantasy Writers of America, where if you sell two short stories to qualifying markets, then you qualify to become a member, and you can actually get insurance as a member of the SFWA, so there's one of the benefits. But it also gives you some writing credits, so that when you do go before an agent or a publisher, you can say, my work has been published in this paying qualifying market, and it does mean something. If you just happen to sell a story to Fred's Magazine that, you know, a guy just started in his basement, that's great, but it may not qualify in the eyes of many in the publishing industry if it's not one of those big mainstream markets. So what I decided to do was use my technical skills. I'm a computer guy. I've been a computer guy for years, and I thought, I understand the internet. I understand website development. I have some graphical editing skills. I can do some of these things myself, and I can start to take advantage of a new opportunity. I wasn't real interested in pursuing an agent through the traditional means, mainly because of time. In order for me to be respectful of an agent that I was querying, generally that agent will want you to query them exclusively. And I have to put all my papers together, put it in an envelope, send it out to an agent, and then wait 6 weeks, 8 weeks, hoping, and then getting the form rejection letter. And for many people, that form rejection letter is just a slap in the face, and it does sting. The first one you get will not be pleasant if you decide to go that route. But most writers, especially successful writers, learn that it's not personal. It doesn't mean your writing's terrible, and it doesn't mean that you're a failure. It just means that that person that day found a reason not to pick up your work. And if you put yourself in their shoes with a pile of work this high and you're sifting through all of it, yeah, you'd probably skip yourself a couple times too. So you come to the realization that they're not out to get you, and the fact that they didn't take the time to write you a letter to say why they rejected your book and to give you all those reasons, it's not personal. I think it's probably one of the most difficult things for a writer is to send work to someone, get a form rejection letter, and not know why. But it is the challenge that most are faced with. If you do get feedback from an agent or an editor, it's a very good sign. They stopped and took enough time to generate a response to you. That's a very positive sign. If you get feedback from someone who rejects you, that's probably a step up from the form rejection letter, which is, we really didn't have any interest at this time. So I started looking at, okay, is there another way for me to do this? And one of my good friends, Steve McCarthy, I always thank Steve for this because he bugged me for months about J.C. Hutchins and Scott Sigler, who were putting out their work as serialized audiobooks for free on patiobooks.com and building huge audiences of all the people who have MP3 players. You know, that's a huge market that is rapidly emerging. And granted, most people listen to music on their MP3 players. But a lot of commuters and people who have the ability to listen but not read are finding that they can get their reading fixed during their daily commute, some of which even while they're doing their job. My friend Steve, who was bugging me, is actually a glassblower. And has the ability to sit there and listen to audiobooks while he creates scientific instruments. I just found that fascinating, that here's this market that I didn't realize was there, and it's growing huge. So when you looked at, I started looking at what Scott had done, and I started looking at what JC had done, and a number of other podcast authors, and I really found that I enjoyed it. Now, whenever I go on a road trip, I make sure I go to Patio Books. I download an audio book for my road trip, and it makes the trip go faster. So I started to see the value that these audio files were starting to present, because I knew it was going to be a lot of work to sit down and read this book out loud from start to finish without making a single mistake. No, I didn't do that. I messed up so much. Can you imagine trying to do that? But that was part of the challenge, was knowing that I'm not a narrator. I'm not naturally gifted at reading aloud. It was going to be a challenge for me. And you listened to that first bit of audio I played when everybody was coming in, that it wasn't stellar. I got the job done. I got the words out of my mouth. But I wasn't engaging in my inflection. There was monotony to the way that I said those words. And I had patterns in my speech that I didn't realize until I'd done 10 hours of recording and editing. And it really, the recording is one thing, and that's a challenge. But the editing process is a really big challenge, because when you sit there to go through and listen to that hour of audio and find the places where you made the mistakes, and learning how, when you make a mistake, how to properly retake it. Because I didn't like to stop. If I made a mistake, I would just pause and take a moment and then start again. And I realized I had to start way back at the beginning of the sentence so that I wasn't splicing sentences together in the audio and making them sound awkward. Which, you know, it's one of the things that you learn. One of the nice things about the Patio Books environment is you're not expected to be a professional narrator. You're not expected to be a professional audio editor, because the content you're providing is free. Therefore, the audience is much more forgiving. A lot of novelists will use the podcast portion as a feedback session with listeners. So as they're producing, some actually podcast while they write their book, which I actually think is insane and I don't recommend it. I would recommend finishing the book, editing the book, and then putting out the audio, mainly because at that point you are serving your audience. This is your first impression with your audience. Let's say you've got 5 episodes up there, and then you decide you've got writer's block, editor's block, life comes at you, and stuff's happening, and your audience wants to know, where's the next episode? And, you know, there's actually a term for people who get lost in the middle and it never gets done. It's called pod fade. And there are a lot of podcasters out there who realize that other podcasters are just leaving their work in the middle unfinished. And for anybody who's watched a television show or a movie and get cut off halfway through, that's an unpleasant experience. You want to know what happens. So from my perspective, when I put out my podcast novels, I actually finished 3 books. I recorded the entire book, edited the entire book, and put it live on patiobooks.com in one day. That had a great advantage that when it came out, it was marked as complete. And all the listeners who refused to even start a podcast before it was finished jumped on, and I've got a huge amount of downloads very, very early on. I learned a valuable lesson, however, that I missed out on an opportunity, because other podcasters were releasing 1 episode a week. And every time they released an episode, they made the front page of patiobooks.com at the very top that said, new episode release. So you have to look at that and say, you know, there's some trade-offs there. Putting it out over time has its advantages of generating a lot of time on the front page right at the top. And for me, that's what I learned about the internet, is it's all about eyeballs. Seeing your name, seeing your cover art, seeing your blurb. I expanded that over time to be eyeballs and ear holes. You know, I want to put content in front of your eyes, and I want to put content in your ears, and you'll remember who I am. In marketing, a lot of people say they have to see your message 5 times. A consumer has to see your message 5 times before they will want to buy your product. So I took that to heart. Is it 7? Okay, I was aiming low, so you got to go for 7. So that's an important lesson right there, because it applies very much to selling books and in a number of different ways. One, the more time somebody sees your cover art and sees your name, the more likely they are to remember you and to think, you know, that guy might have something I want because I keep seeing it everywhere. It's everywhere. I must have to have that. And there is a psychology behind that. So when I said, okay, now I've put my work up on patiobooks.com, I'm a one-trick pony. I've got one outlet. You can come to this one website and you can listen to my stuff. And that was great. And in truth, patiobooks.com does a couple of other things for me, which is put me on iTunes, put me on Zune, and feeding me out to content syndicators. People in the internet world know that content is king. If you don't have content, you don't have anything to keep people coming back. So by generating content and syndicating content, people can then pull content from a feed and serve it out to their audience. So by putting it up in one location at Podio Books that then feeds a syndication network, I'm getting my work out through a lot of different channels. So if you go to iTunes and you type in my name, you'll find something. Which, you know, considering the fact that all I did was publish it on Podio Books, from the work aspect for me, that was very nice to have that automatically done for me. So then I started looking at what some other podcast novelists were doing, which is realizing that some people like to listen when they want to listen, but they're all readers at heart. And a lot of people will want to read the same work that they've listened to. It's a very different experience. It interacts with our brain differently, and we experience it differently. So what a lot of podcast novelists started doing was releasing a PDF version of their book at the same time that they posted a chapter of audio. They would post a PDF version and allow people to read that. So what this allowed them to do was put their work out to a large number of people, build up a following, some of them absolutely rabid, like Scott Sigler. He has a following of just fans that go over the top for his type of horror and thrillers. And when you've achieved that, when you finish that next book and you go to a publisher and you say, I've got a mass of raving fans who are ready for my next book, it's a lot easier to convince them that you're a good risk to take. Then they'll actually want to look at your book. And now you've gotten past the business hurdle and we can get to the art part. You know, because we're all artists as writers, and we want to look at it as art. But when it goes to that shelf, it's business. So we have to get past the business part to get to the art part. Now we can look at, is the book commercially viable? You know, because that's the other part about art. You know, some types of art are really wonderful and worth celebrating, but they're not going to sell. And so if you want to be an author, at some point you have to look at your motivation. What am I trying to accomplish? Am I trying to accomplish becoming a best-selling author with a large following, and I want to do this as a living? Then you very well need to look at the commercial viability of your work. If you're saying, you know what, I just want my story to be heard, and I want to get it out there, just as valid. Absolutely just as valid, but it'll take you a different path because your priorities are different. With somebody who just wants to get their story heard, and profit is not as much of a motivation, it's very easy to move low-cost or free stories on the internet as ebooks, as PDFs. I fall in the middle. I wanted to get my story out there. I wanted to share it with people. I wanted to get feedback. But I also want to become a professional writer. It is my goal to, at some point in my life, be paid just for writing. But I know it's going to take me a while to get there. I've achieved great strides from when I started to the point that now at least I regularly get paid for writing, which is an improvement over not getting paid at all. You know, to actually get something coming in every month is an accomplishment, because what I started to realize again was quantity has a great deal to do with how people view authors. If you have one book on the shelf, you walk up to a bookshelf and you see 10 books by this author, 5 books by that author, and 1 by the author on the end, which one are you most likely going to pick up? For many people, it's the one with 10 books, because if I want to fall in love with a writer's writing, I want more to go for. So I started realizing there's a psychology behind that as well. So all back to the eyeballs and ear holes approach to marketing, if I have just one title, I don't have so many shelf opportunities for that one title. If I had 3 titles, that's 3 times as much shelf space, it's 3 times as many graphic images, and that's where I looked at what I had done with producing the Dawning of Power trilogy as a single book may not have been the best approach for all markets. Originally, when I put out the ebook version of this, the ebook mirrored this version that contained all 3 books in the trilogy in a single volume, and it did moderately well. About a year ago, it's been about 8 months ago. I decided for ebook purposes, because it wasn't that difficult for me to take this cover art and repurpose it for three individual books, each one a different color. So instead of the green, I had a yellowish or red and a purple. And I republished them as ebooks individually. At one point, I thought, well, maybe I should take down the one that has all three combined. But it eventually occurred to me, you know what? What I really want to do is give away my first ebook, make the second and third ebooks very inexpensive, 99 cents each, and I'm going to take the one that's all three in one and say, you know what? If you want this for convenience sake, it's $3. It's $2.99. So it's a dollar more than if you bought them individually. I really didn't think it would sell, but it does. So there was another lesson for me, was just because you don't think it'll work doesn't mean it won't. So you have to be careful about limiting yourself to trying things because you think, that'll never work. Part of my approach has been try 100 things and see if 10 of them work. Sometimes they will, sometimes they won't, and then go back and see if you can do those 10 things better. And eventually you will start to find things that work well and get your name out there. So I mentioned that I had that first ebook free, and there's actually a model, a marketing model called freemium, which is based on the fact that you give the consumer content for free to introduce them to your work, to give them the opportunity at no financial risk to them to find out if they like your writing, and then offer them additional materials at a higher price. For me, I stuck with a low price point because my purpose was to generate sales. Not necessarily profits, but sales. Because I could, and I did for a long time, sell my ebook, the three books together, for $8. And I made a pretty good amount of money doing that. However, it failed me in one sense, in that I was making more money, but I was generating less sales. And one of the things that I realized is that if I want to go back to agents and publishers and present myself, I want to have a market and audience that is quantifiable, that I can show you actual numbers behind my platform, and that way I can demonstrate this is how great my reach is as a media outlet. So what I realized was sales was a big part of the evaluation process. If you go to an agent and you have previous sales, one of the first things they're going to do is they're going to look you up in BookScan. Does everybody know what BookScan is? BookScan is essentially, I'm going to call it a ratings warehouse as far as tracking the sales of books. When a book gets sold through the register here, that sale will get registered in the BookScan database. So that when you go to an agent and you say, hey, here my previous book did well, they're going to go look up the ISBN in BookScan and see exactly how many sales went through cash registers. So that number can be very powerful for someone who is generating sales at the cash registers of outlets that participate in BookScan. It can also work against you if you don't realize it's there and you tell prospective agent, I've had 6,000 sales, and they go look it up on BookScan and see 5. Because you might want to tell your agent when you say that I have 6,000 sales, that they're through these outlets, such as ebooks, that do not go through BookScan. So BookScan is specifically for print books sold through cash registers at stores that participate in the BookScan program. So it's just one of those things to keep in mind. I met with an agent at a writer's conference in New Jersey. And I was talking with him about my approach of building an audience. And he pulled out a form that all of his prospective authors fill out. And he wants to know, how many Twitter followers do you have? How many Facebook friends do you have? How many subscribers do you have to your newsletter? What were your previous sales? What were your previous sales expected through BookScan? Those are the types of information that that agent is using to evaluate how viable that author will be as a commercial artist. So in today's world, it's becoming more and more important to look at marketing avenues outside of paid marketing. Many authors today, if you get a book deal, and you get that big advance you've been dreaming out for a long time, it can come as a big shock that many authors turn around and take the majority of that advance and spend it on marketing. And you would ask yourself, why would they do that? Right? That was their income from the book, so to speak. Why on earth would I take my advance and chunk it into marketing? Part of it comes down to that risk about being on the bookstore shelves. You have a window when your book is released. And one of the things that you very much want to do if you release a book in print is to have a buzz built before the book hits the shelves so that the day it hits the shelves, you can generate enough sales to hit bestseller lists, to demonstrate the sales not only to your publisher, but to the booksellers themselves. Right? The booksellers are your end market, and so it's important for booksellers to have something to convince them that your book is worth putting on the shelf. A podcast novelist that I'm friendly with, who's now gone on to get an agent and get a book deal in New York and is doing extremely well, used the download numbers from patiobooks.com as part of the selling sheet. That's something that, you know, I didn't realize existed early on in my career. There was this thing as a tip sheet or a sell sheet that shows reasons that a bookseller could consider buying this book and putting it on the shelf. And one of those things is, what other avenues does this author have to get the word out to generate sales? Because publishers at this point, from my understanding, don't spend as much marketing a title as they used to. And it's really up to the author to make a book successful. When you reach a certain amount of fame, it's done for you. And I know that there's a lot of writers out there who are frustrated that they've written this wonderful book that they want to get on the bookshelves and they want people to read. And they see celebrities producing books that maybe they didn't even write, but it has their name on them, and publishers are scooping those up and printing them. Why? Because people will buy them, and that will feed the publisher's families. So it's a business sense. It makes good business sense. So that's where it had to make good business sense for me to come back and say, okay, I've got my next book ready. Here's what I've built up for my tip sheet, for my platform. This is how I'm going to get the word out to the rest of the world that I've got my new book ready to go, and hopefully there's a bunch of people out there who already want it. And I've reached the point now where I feel there's enough demand for my work that as soon as I finish my next book, that part, you have to do that. You have to write the next book, which I'm struggling with that, but I'm getting there, and it's more a struggle of time than anything else. I don't know about everybody here, but I struggle with finding my muse when I'm stressed and when I'm harried or when I'm tired or when someone has aggravated me. I have a very tough time just sitting down and writing after that. A lot of authors, and as a matter of fact, there are people at Writer's Digest who have said this. I believe Jane Friedman was the one who said in an interview that authors should spend equal time marketing and writing. And that's a hard pill to swallow. For me, I actually have a hard time spending as much time writing as I do marketing, because it becomes a cycle that can be very time-consuming. Especially when you reach a point where, for me, I wanted to engage fans personally. I wanted to be very open and available to anybody who wanted to send me an email and say, hey, why did this happen? You know, I actually had a reader contact me a couple of days ago who wanted to know what the scale was on the maps so he could figure out the distances on my maps.
Oh, cool.
And I just thought that was so cool. Of course, I had to sit there and scratch my head and go, oh, shoot, I know I had that scale figured out at some point or another. I had to figure out how long it took him to get from here to here, and I figured out this far, and I have to go through that exercise again because I don't think I kept that note. So you don't expect those sort of things, but it does become an investment of time. For a while, I advertised with Google AdWords. Do you know what Google AdWords are? If you go to Google, and I'll show you an example here, we'll just go to Google. What we will see is that the top Wikipedia there, this is a regular result in a Google search. In other words, it was nobody paid to show up there. But this guy over here is an ad. Somebody paid to show up there for that keyword, and they bid so much that for every time somebody clicks on that link, that advertiser will pay a certain amount. And based on the amount that they've bid, we'll determine how often they show up in a search for what terms and how high they show up. So for a competitive term, you know, something where there's a lot of people advertising for the same space, the cost per click goes way up. But if you happen to be in a space where it's not all that competitive, you can get your clicks fairly cheap. For example, 5 cents a click. I'll actually be doing a AdWords campaign this weekend because Google was kind enough to send me $100 in free clicks because I hadn't advertised in a while, which I'll get back to. But I'm going to take that $100 in free clicks and I'm going to I'm going to bid 5 cents a click and I'm going to drive it to my free content. I don't want to make any money off of it. I want more people to be exposed to my work, and if they're exposed to that first one, then they have the opportunity to say, I really enjoyed that, let me go get the second and the third, and I'll look forward to the fourth when it comes out. And that's my sales strategy, is give it to them, let them check it out, and hopefully they'll want more. Essentially, with AdWords, I was paying per click. I was generating a quantifiable amount of traffic. I could look at a report, and if done properly, you can actually figure out how many clicks did it take to generate a sale. How much did it cost me to make that sale? How much margin do I have? Because that's part of, you know, when you start talking about the business of it, what did it cost me to print this book? It cost me $7 to print this book and get it shipped to me by doing a quantity of 1,000. Now, if I take all the other costs that went up to the point that I printed it, I probably have $8 in this book. Retails for $19.99. You might think, wow, that's a pretty good profit margin. But when you start looking at the fact that the venue that sells the book is going to need to make a portion of that, right? Anywhere from 40% up to sell it on Amazon through Amazon Managed, 55%. Okay, so now I'm selling this book for $9. Well, I've got $8 in it. That means I'm making $1. I haven't counted the fact that I have to ship it to Amazon. And that cost me $2.30 to ship media mail. I'm in the hole to sell this book on Amazon. That's not a good place to be. So part of the problem that a lot of self-publishers see today is that I did really well. I made an investment on this. Shelled out $7,000 to print 1,000 copies, but I have some profit margin. If I sell this book myself, I do very well. So I put out the effort to try and sell the book myself. If I sell it through an independent bookstore, you know, I'm still doing okay because generally you're talking 40 to 50% on consignment. You can get a better deal. The bookstore makes money, you make a little bit of money. It's not a bad way to go. Working with independent bookstores is a great way for independent authors to get their work out, do events like this, and everybody benefits. But if you go to a self-publisher, if I tried to print on demand this book, I would lose money for every copy printed because they generally charge by the page. And this is a 700-page book, and it does not fit within the economics of print-on-demand. Print-on-demand, you want a 200 to 300-page book that you're going to pay $7 or $8 to have printed, and you're going to sell for $16 to $17.99. Now, that is kind of a pie-in-the-sky scenario, and many people who go with self-publishing learn the hard way that their books are overpriced. You got a 250-page book that's selling for $17.99. That's not a bargain. And then when you realize as the author, you can't buy that book at a 50% discount. Therefore, how do you get a stock of books that you can go out to independent booksellers with and say, I want to give you a consignment deal when you don't have any margin left? So it's very difficult to actually make money printing books and selling them without overpricing them. If you price yourself out of the market, you've just wasted a lot of time and money producing a product that nobody's going to buy. And what I see a lot of people who have gone through that route suffering with is when they realize that, they can't get their rights back. They're stuck. Their book is now hostage to a system that's not going to generate any sales. So if you're going to publish in any manner, self-publishing, small press, large press, understand what happens if your book goes out of print. Do the rights revert to you at any point in time? what are your digital rights, and what are you being paid for them. Those are all very, very, and audio as well. Because if you sell the rights, it doesn't mean the publisher has to produce the media that they bought the rights for. And that's another kicker that authors are finding today, is that they sell their digital rights, but their ebooks aren't in all the different venues. And they get frustrated, but they don't own the rights to it anymore, so they can't put it in additional channels. And for me, that was my whole philosophy, was if I'm going to put out something, I want it to be everywhere. I want every store you go to for somewhere for me to be on that shelf and have the opportunity for your eyes to hit my cover art, because that's my opportunity. In some ways, traditional publishing has lost some of its appeal to authors. I know a couple of authors, one gentleman named Scott Nicholson, and for those of you who want to go out and check out PatioRacket.com, there's an interview with Scott Nicholson talking about his journey from published writer in the 80s to full-time ebook novelist in 2010. No print in there at all, and he's finally been able to transition to full-time writer. So there are different avenues that you can take. When I look at what Scott has done, one, he has great writing. He has a lot of fans, but he has a lot of books, about a dozen titles. So if you search for Scott on Amazon, you get a big old list. And numbers compound on the internet. And I'll give you an example. How many of you have shopped on Amazon or another online bookseller? When you go and you find your book, there are other books listed there. Do you ever click on them? You ever see something that interests you? You say, ooh, look at that. Mm-hmm. Okay, so people who bought this bought that. Extremely important in the digital economy, because sales generate sales. It's somewhat paradoxical. It's kind of like when you were a teenager and you wanted to get your first credit card and they said you don't have any credit. If you want to sell a lot of ebooks, you need to sell a lot of ebooks, because every one that you sell will increase your visibility. Because one sale to a customer who's bought 40 other books just associated your book with 40 other books. Now, the more sales you generate and the more times that happens, the more likely you are to show up on the people who bought this, bought that. The more likely you are to show up in bestseller lists. The more likely you are to show up as relevant or related. And those are all opportunities where somebody who doesn't know anything about you all of a sudden sees your cover art. And that's another point I'm going to make real quick, is that I can see that book from here and know that Walter Mosley wrote Known to Evil. When book designers design a cover, you want to be able to see that cover and read it from 6 feet away. Well, the same type of logic goes into when you're designing a book cover for online. If it doesn't look good as a little thumbnail, you've missed an opportunity. I learned from my own mistakes on that my cover art doesn't look as good as a thumbnail as I want. So when I do my next one, I will make darn good and sure that thumbnail, you can read the title, you can see something engaging about that little tiny image, because that's your opportunity. Your billboard as an author has become that big. So you need to be aware of that and make sure it's going to look good. The other thing is ratings. And this was something I learned through my experiment of putting out a free ebook, was what happens when, if you go to look at a book and it has zero ratings and zero reviews, no matter what its sales rank is, you might look at it a little dubiously and wonder, do I really want to shell out and be the first one to find out if this book is awful? But if you see that a book has 120 ratings, it creates an entirely different perception of the book, the author, even if it's 3 stars. You might think, well, 120 other people obviously read that and rated it and didn't think it was the worst thing ever. Maybe it's worth me putting out my money and trying it. So this is that whole critical mass, right? When you take the number of sales that have occurred and start filtering it out to the number of other book pages that you start showing up on. I've met a number of authors just because our book showed up on each other's pages. And I've had a lot of people who I know came to me as a reader because they saw me in relation to someone else's work. And that was a shift in mindset for me, because when I first came out as a fantasy author, in my mind, if I'm honest, I viewed other fantasy authors as my competition. It was a fairly natural way to feel about it. But what I've learned since then is not only are they not my competition, and a lot of times they're my audience. And they're my allies. Part of the realization that I came to is the people who enjoy my work want more now. And I can't do it. Therefore, there's absolutely no way that I can satisfy the reading appetites of my audience. Wouldn't it be nice if I let my audience know, hey, if you really liked my work, maybe you should go check out Philippa Ballantyne's Geist. It's similar, she's a friend of mine, another independent writer gone and done well, and working together, we can share each other's audiences. So you don't have to look at other writers as competition as much as they're the people who will lift you up. They're the people that will help you. And certain genres definitely foster that community type of environment. Some don't as much. But the sci-fi, fantasy, speculative fiction writers generally tend to form a very active community that's supportive of each other. And probably the number one thing I hear about podcasters is that same thing, that podcasts, writers, and authors will help you. And that's, you know, as somebody just sitting in your house, all by yourself, looking at your computer, you can feel somewhat insignificant in the grand scheme of things. But if you take the opportunity to connect with an author you respect, somebody you've read for years, somebody you think, wow, this person, you know, would never even think, you know, to give me the time of day, you might be really surprised to find out that they're just regular people. And some of them, it makes their day when you contact them. And then there are others who are just busy and might not have time. But I've connected with a number of these authors, and most of them were willing to take some time to talk with me, tell me what worked for them and what didn't work, and that we would come up with ways to help each other share audiences, run promos for each other. That's probably the number one thing with podcast novelists is running promos for each other. Right? If you've broken out your audio into these episodes, and I'll back up a little bit in explaining podiobooks.com as a model, in that serialized audio fiction is different from an audio book. In that serialized audio fiction is like a television episode. It has a little music at the beginning, it's got a little intro, got a little music at the end, so it's kind of like its own little episode, and it's not necessarily meant or originally intended to be listened to back-to-back. Now, you might catch one episode a week, just as you would your favorite television show. So that's the whole serialized audio versus audiobook. With audiobook, you generally have one intro at the beginning of the book and an outro at the end of the book, and that's it. And then everything in between is a straight read. One of the nice things about that differentiation is if you've taken all the time to produce the audio and you know that there are people who don't want to hear the chatter at the beginning and the end of every chapter or every episode, you can create a premium version of that content with no chatter, no advertisements, none of that sort of thing that tends to creep into podcasting, and create an actual audiobook. Podiobooks.com actually offers the ability to publish your premium audio on Audible.com, Amazon.com, and iTunes. Even though you're giving away content, there are people who are willing to pay for a premium version of that content. So I sell the same audio that I give away. Seems like a strange model, but there's a market for each. There's a market that loves free, and there's a market that says I'd rather pay for the premium. So it's just something to show that whole freemium model. Sometimes you can give something away and charge for it at the same time and everybody will be happy. And that's okay. The market, you just have to look at the markets differently. With the ebooks, I give away the first ebook in every market except for Amazon. Amazon, I have to charge 99 cents for it because Amazon will not let me put a free book on their system. They stopped doing that a while back. There are some out there, but I can't make it free. At first, I was very frustrated by that. I contacted Amazon. I asked them, why can't they make it free? Come on, let's work something out. Let's do a deal. Let's do something so I can get this out to all these readers and get the snowball effect started on Amazon. And they basically said, no. And I'm now glad they did, because they did something I totally did not expect, which was to make the title free on their own for a limited period of time and pay my royalty for every free download. I didn't see that coming, I have to admit. But essentially, back in October of last year, there was a weekend where they chose series of books where the first book was low price, and the second and third books, from what I could tell, were all similarly priced, 99 cent to 299 range, and they made the first book free for a weekend and generated 3,000 sales in 4 days that I didn't see coming. So sometimes you have to realize that serendipity will be involved in your path to publishing, and you may get there in a way you never expected. I've had a lot of the things that I've tried fail miserably, and things that I didn't think had any chance at all of being remotely successful take off wildly. As an example, I've created iPhone apps and Android apps for smartphones, which I thought would take off like hotcakes and do really well. And I also put out an application just for regular old Nokia cell phones. Now, I would have expected the iPhone and Android app to do extremely well, and the one for the Nokia cell phone to maybe generate a little bit of interest. It is the other way around. The Nokia cell phone is currently driving hundreds of visitors to my website every day, and the Android and iPhone apps are doing 20 or 30 a month. So you kind of have to just try a lot of things and not be afraid to fall on your face. And if you do fall on your face, don't worry about it. As a perfect example, I sat right here a year and a half ago and did a book signing. And I think I had one person show up. And that was a humbling moment. But it also taught me that you don't let a humbling moment stop you from trying again. Now, here I am back today, and I've got six wonderful people listening to me talk about ebooks and publishing, and I feel very good about that. I wanted to do well. This is my hometown. I live here, and I wanted to come to my local independent bookstore and do something good. So it feels really good to be here today, and it also shows I'm glad I didn't let it stop me. I'm glad I didn't say, that's it, nobody came to my book signing, I'm taking my books and I'm going home. So you have to be willing to put yourself out there. As soon as you do, you open yourself up to all kinds of things, good and bad. When you put your work out to a large amount of people, some of them might hate it. And they might be the first one who has the gumption to review it. And boy, that's hard to take when your first review is a one star and somebody just goes on about how terrible your writing was. But it's a really nice thing when somebody comes back and says, hey, you know what? I liked that. And that does make you feel good. One of the other things, you know, they say any press is press. Even bad press is good press. I never really believed that. But in getting my work out and making it free, I was very surprised to attract a very popular book reviewer who read all three of my books and wrote what I can only call a mediocre review of them. They were not too bad for free. You know, I'm glad this wasn't priced more because then I would have been mad. You know, but I looked at that and said, okay, maybe that was not the nicest thing anybody said, but I track my statistics very closely. And my download statistics went from 20 a day to 300 a day based on that one review. That he didn't even say anything nice. Well, he said it was okay, so I guess that wasn't mean. But one mediocre review tripled my, well, more than tripled it, almost 10 times the number of downloads I was getting per day, and it stayed there for months. So it wasn't just a momentary spike. It has never gone back down. It's still there. And because of that, I've now had, you know, over 10,000 downloads of that first book, and it's starting to snowball. Because of that, some other opportunities have come my way. You know, I wanted to get my short stories out there. I wrote short stories specifically for magazines that I read their guidelines. You know, I wanted to get my two stories so I could join the SFWA and get insurance. You know, that was kind of my goal. And so I wrote these stories, and then I didn't have the guts to actually send them to the magazine at one point. They just sat there. And through getting my work out, all of a sudden I had publishers contacting me and say, hey, we're putting out a new magazine. Do you have any content? Do you have anything you'd be willing to sell us? And so I've sold some stories into markets that I never expected. They actually came to me. Who saw that coming? But what I did is I realized I had created the perception that I was professional, that I meant business, I presented a professional image, that I was not a hack, that I was not an amateur, that I was not an aspiring writer, that I was a writer. And people start to take you the way you present yourself to them. As a teenager, I moved away from my hometown. I had a very bad reputation. I was a bad boy. I was a rebel. And I moved somewhere else. And I learned that in that new place where nobody knew me, nobody knew anything about me except what I showed them. And that's the same way it is when you go out on the internet. Nobody knows anything about you except what you choose to present to them. If you go to twitter.com/Brian Rathbone, what you will see is that a picture of me here, and there's a picture of my cover art, and in the sidebar here, I call it the Opportunity Zone. Okay, that's my billboard. My goal with Twitter, and a lot of people say, you know, Twitter, I don't get it. I didn't get it for a long time. Why do I want to know what people had for lunch? Well, that's totally irrelevant. If the people you're following only are talking about what they had for lunch, they're probably not the right people to follow. The whole point of Twitter is it's a communication medium, and it's a very instantaneous communication medium. Where it differs from something like Facebook, because when I started out, I thought, you know what, I'll use Facebook to sell books by connecting with all these other people and letting them know I have my book out there. And that worked really well for the first few hundred copies with all of my friends, the people I went to high school with, the people I worked with, family members. I could guilt into buying 10 copies, you know. That all worked. But it gets to a point where you run out. You only have so many people you can contact on Facebook. So then you say, well, you know, do I want to connect with other fantasy readers? Well, on Facebook, if I add you as a friend and you don't know me, it can be very creepy. Why do you want to be my friend? I don't know you. Where Twitter is a little bit different. When you follow somebody on Twitter, you're not necessarily saying, I want to be your friend. You're saying, I think you might have something interesting to say. And I think you're worth listening to. And that's a completely different vibe. Therefore, it's very easy to connect with people who share a common interest on Twitter. So when I went on, I said, okay, first off, I don't want to sell anything on Twitter, because that's the wrong thing. Nobody wants to go onto a social network and have people say, buy my book, buy my book, buy my book. It's not what they're there for. So how do I sell books, that's what I'm there for, without being a pushy sales guy? And the best way I found to do that was to promote other people, to use my marketing, very passive. A billboard back there, I've got a link that points to my website. If you come look at my profile, it's going to be pretty obvious. I write fantasy books, and you can go here to find out about them, and you can get the first one free, but I'm not going to say that. What I might say is, check out this person's book. Here's what's happening in the publishing industry today. Check out this person's blog post. You know, by providing useful information, I make myself attractive as somebody to follow, because I'm bringing value to the table instead of just being a marketing outlet with a megaphone saying, buy my book, buy my book. What I've found from doing that is that over time, I have built up a following of people who are writers, readers, fantasy fans, science fiction fans, geeks, nerds. We all fit in the same bucket, and we all kind of get along, and we share information with each other, and it started to grow and mushroom, and I had a very supportive community behind me. When I started, I didn't know who to follow. I was just randomly following people I found, and then it hit me. One of the first exercises as a writer is, who is your work similar to? When you go to sell books, everybody's going to want to know. And you might not want to do it. You might not want to say, oh, I don't want to pigeonhole it. Do it. Find somebody you respect whose work is like yours and say, my book is like Melanie Ron's The Dragon Prince. That's the most closely related title I could think of. It's similar to Ellie Modesitt's work in The Magic of Recluse. It's like Terry Brooks in some way and some of his less lighthearted stuff. So once I've done that, I've identified, hey, people who like Terry Brooks, Ellie Modesitt, Melanie Ron, chances are they'll like my books. I wonder if they're on Twitter. And I wonder if all the people following them on Twitter aren't their fans. Now, I have a public way to go in and find all these fantasy fans. And I can follow them. And one of the tricks that I used, you'll notice that in my Twitter profile, my username is at Brian Rathbone. Now, most people, when they sign up to Twitter, would have made their name Brian Rathbone. I didn't want to do that. It's redundant. It's my opportunity zone. Put some message there, or as you find in the internet world, keywords. What are people going to search for if they're trying to find other fantasy authors on Twitter? Well, they'll probably type in fantasy author. So if you happen to go to Twitter and you search for fantasy author, I'm going to show up. Also has the extra benefit, if you happen to go to Google and type in fantasy author, a keyword combination I've been trying to target for years, my website will not come up. But my Twitter profile will, because it's an extremely high-ranked web page that has my keywords associated to me, and that brings traffic to my page, and as soon as they see my backdrop, they say, oh, he's got books for free, here's his website, and they come to my website. So Twitter works absolutely wonderful as a way to find your market, find an audience, connect with people, and my favorite, pump traffic to your website. Because a lot of people will say, I can't type anything in 140 characters, why would I bother? And they've missed the point. They've missed the opportunity that Twitter is the way to tell everybody about the big article you just wrote on your website that they're not going to. So I just wrote a great article on my website. I want everybody to know about it. I post it on my website, let it out to the Facebook people, but it's really not getting any traffic. So I go to Twitter and I say, hey, everybody, I just put out a great blog post about this. And then I put a link to it. Open the floodgates, and here come all the people. And if I really, really want to push my luck, I'll say, please retweet. So that other people on Twitter will go, okay, yeah, that's worth telling people about. I'll tell all my fans. I'll tell all my friends. And that's where, and then they start telling people, and they start telling people, and you start to get a gauge on how effective was this. Because that's part of it. When you go out and you're working on Facebook, and you're working on Twitter, and you're doing all this stuff, and you say, am I getting anywhere? Is any of this worthwhile? And that's where it comes back. You've heard me say a number of times that I track everything. Well, one of the ways that I track Twitter, first of all, I use Google Analytics, which is free. Pardon?
It's right there.
What's that? The
your numbers are right there.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, those numbers, these numbers help. Okay.
Yeah.
The fact that I have 17,000 people following me on Twitter, that is significant. Okay? Did you have a question about that?
That's a lot. I was going to say that you're following 18,000, but Google Analytics.
So Google Analytics, if you have a website, Google Analytics is a free tool that you can employ on your website to tell you who's coming to your website, how long did they stay, what did they look at, what keywords did they type into Google to get there, and what websites are referring traffic to you and how much. So when I was running my Google AdWords, and I was spending $150 a month to promote my books, I was generating somewhere around 2,000 visits to my website, which was not a bad value, and I figured out it was costing me $2 or $3 to sell a book. I was okay. I was happy with that. And then I started getting good at Twitter, and I started connecting with all these people at Twitter. And next thing you know, I'm generating 5 and 6 and 7,000 visits a website to my month from Twitter, which didn't cost me anything except an hour a day.
And the analytics?
The analytics showed
coming from.
It showed Google cost per click, and then all of a sudden Twitter surpassed it, went all the way to the top, and I thought, why in the world am I spending $150 a month paying for clicks when I'm generating 5 times that amount of traffic from Twitter, all from promoting other people? And serendipity. Again, I put myself in the place where I'm connected to all these people. A very popular publisher of fantasy books is Tor. And one of the editors at Tor, Janet Tor, is on Twitter. I follow her, and a number of the other people I follow her. And one day she put out a tweet that said, hey, is there a list of fantasy authors on Twitter? I found a list of sci-fi authors on Twitter, but I haven't found a list of fantasy authors. And I said, opportunity! There isn't one, and I'm going to make one right now. So I created the Twitter fantasy list, which is on my website, and essentially put out the word that said, if you were involved in fantasy fiction, if you're a writer, if you're a podcaster, if you're an artist, you belong on this list. That way the fantasy community can find each other using this list. And it crashed my website for months. I had to upgrade my web server. I had to spend a lot of money I didn't have to get it to where my web server could handle the amount of traffic that that list generated. And so a very simple, small thing, just as a list of fantasy writers on Twitter, pours traffic to my website more than I can handle at times. And every time someone gets added, I make an announcement on Twitter that says, hey, so-and-so's just been added to the Twitter fantasy list. Check out their new book, X. And that right there is value to every single person that follows me, because they're all fantasy fans. And they want to know about the new stuff, and they want to know about the new writers. So you can create things that just didn't even exist before and make use out of them, which I find just fascinating. So at this point, I'm going to open up for questions for a bit. Because I've been talking nonstop. So, while I take a drink, anybody have a question?
Yes.
All right. I'll let you have the first one.
Well, I want to know this. When we do the digital text platform.
Yes.
Or the audio, do we have to have copyrights? File copyrights.
You do not have to purchase copyrights. Inherently, your work is copyrighted just by you writing it. And when you publish on what is now known as the Kindle digital Kindle distribution platform, it used to be DTP, digital text platform, which was Amazon's road onto the Kindle for ebooks. Basically, what you need to get onto Kindle Word document of your manuscript that is lightly formatted. And when I say lightly formatted, I mean bold, italics, underlined, maybe a little bit of centered text, and that's it. No drop caps,
no
very few
separate
pictures. You can do pictures, but they're limited. Yeah, I mean, you want to keep them small and realize that they're going to show up on a black and white screen most of the time. That's not designed to show pictures. So if your book is a comic book, Kindle might not be the place to publish it. It might not go well in that medium.
I just got another question then.
Okay,
go
ahead.
Question. They all go with that question. Okay, then what is a certificate of ownership, a digital certificate of ownership, like on Creative Space? It says that you have to have some kind of ownership.
I have not used CreateSpace directly. But I can tell you that they may require some certification that you still own the rights to your book, that you've not sold those rights to a publisher and now just decided that you're going to publish it on Kindle and XYZ publisher actually owns those digital rights. So for me, in dealing with Amazon, as a publisher, generally when I publish something on Amazon, they will ask me for my contracts. And I'm saying this from a publisher standpoint. I actually, after I formed my own company to print The Dawning of Power, I put out the ebooks myself, I learned all these things, and then all of my author friends said, well, hey, we'd like to do that, but we don't want to learn how to do that, we just want you to do it. And I thought, well, if you give me a little piece, I'll do that. So I became a royalty-paying digital publisher back in 2009. And have sold many, many books for many, many people, and it's a really good thing. But when I go as a publisher and I publish a new author's title on Amazon, they're going to ask me for the contract. And I'm going to have to send them the contract to prove that I have the rights to those, to the digital ebook. Now, if that book has already been published in print, not only do I have to prove the contract that I have with the author that says I own the rights to the digital content, but I actually have to get a letter from the print publisher that says, yes, they truly do own those digital rights and we don't own them. So it's assumed at the distributor level that if somebody's already put out a print version of a book, that they also own the digital version until you prove otherwise.
Well, then what is this? A W-A-B-E-N that contains an IRS T-I-N.
That's going to be, I believe, W-A-B-E-N. I believe they're looking for tax information there. And generally, as a self-publisher, if you were to form a publishing company, A TIN is a tax identification number, so you would apply for that when you formed your company. If you form a small company like I did, an LLC, with only one member, you can use your own Social Security card as the tax identification number. So more than likely what they're asking for is your
Social
Security
number. That's exactly what they're asking. Oh, you're so wonderful. But I have one more question.
Sure, go ahead.
Sorry, y'all.
That's all right. We'll get yours, and then we'll work around
then
the
room. Then I'll be done. This last question. Well, maybe two more questions. how do you make a book cover? Should you go... Do you try to do this on your end, or do you go to people that make the book covers?
That depends on your level of experience.
What kind of software do you need? That's what I need to know.
Okay, there are free applications that you can use. The number one, I use Photoshop, which is an expensive piece of software. But there's a free open source equivalent to it called the GIMP, G-I-M-P. Which originally was for Linux, and then they made a Windows version and a Mac version, so it's basically free Photoshop. There's a learning curve, I won't lie to you. Photoshop, in some ways, is like brain surgery, so you might be better off with one of the easier programs if you're not a digital artist. Picasa from Google is a free graphics editor that has some limited capabilities. It's not as powerful as Photoshop and the GIMP, but it's a lot easier to use.
I just bought Photoshop, and it's so frustrating.
Yes.
I think it's because it is too strong for my computer. I paid all that money for it, and my memory is just... It's eating it alive, and my computer's crashing every time I do something.
Chances are you need more RAM.
Yeah.
A $40 RAM stick would probably fix the problem of making it run properly, but I will tell you that Photoshop is... If you're going to sit down and learn Photoshop, it's kind of like saying, I want to be a doctor, and I'm starting a brain surgery.
Yeah.
Because it is a complicated application. That, therefore, if you want to go that route... That's how I created this. I created this cover in Photoshop, and essentially, I'm not a very good artist. Okay? I can't draw. So, my aunt, however, is very talented and drew this lady and as a pencil sketch and sent it to me on a piece of paper with this pencil sketch of this lady. And I looked at it and went, I don't think that's going to work. But I have absolutely nothing else to work with at this point. I do like the concept. It fit with the concept and the feel of the book. So I scanned that piece of paper. I put that pencil sketch into Photoshop. I worked on it for way too long. And I got it to where it looked pretty good over a colored background. Now, I don't have the skill to produce that colored background either. But there are artists on the internet who will sell stock artwork. And the site that I bought this from was folkvangar.com, which I can put up a list of these URLs on my website afterwards if that makes it easier for everyone. I meant to do that beforehand, but I admit I'm a slacker. So folkvangar.com is a site of Veronica Antanasio, who's a very talented artist, and she produces really frilly-looking borders and fantasy backgrounds and these pieces of content that you can purchase. I think I paid $35 for 50 backgrounds and caprices and different stylings. And then I took those, put them into Photoshop, smooshed them all together, figured out how to make the lightning using some fancy Photoshop tricks. And after spending way too much time and sending it out to all these people with different versions saying, which one do you like? And we eventually came up with this version. So that is probably one of the most difficult parts. But what I've found is, again, Twitter can come to the rescue. One of the best things that you can do on Twitter is ask a question or ask for a favor. Because there's all these people out there. And I'll give you an example. A good friend of mine was Emery and Rich, was looking for cover art for Nights Nights, her podcast novel. And she went out on the internet looking for artwork that she liked. And she found this really cool vampire artwork and thought, that's it. That's what I want for my cover. So just taking the bull by the horns, she sent the artist an email and said, I really love this piece of artwork that you've done. May I use it as my book cover? And the artist said, no, I've got a better one. Here, use this. And it's beautiful. I love that cover art. But one of the things about it for the artist it's a way for artists to get their name out there, to get people to see their work. I couldn't have produced that cover art to save my life. But there's an artist out there who did that cover art and said, I'm willing to share it. I want to get my name out there. And worked with Emrian on that and her subsequent cover art. So one of the things you just have to be willing to do is put yourself out there. You have to be willing to say, you know what? What's the worst they can say? No. Go away. I don't want to hear from you. That's the worst that's going to happen of just asking somebody. So if you have an idea for your cover art, go out and look for art. What's the name of the website? DeviantArt.com is a... It might be DeviantArt. I might be pronouncing that right. I might have just called everybody Deviants. But it's a great artist. That's all right. I like the taste of shoe leather. There's a great site that you can go out and look at different artists, see what they're doing. At the lowest level, you can go to iStockPhoto.com and find some photos and put those into a basic graphic image manipulation program, put a title on it, put your name on it, and come up with cover art. But any bookseller will tell you cover art sells books. Don't judge a book by its cover, but everybody does.
Yeah.
Okay? Right. I do. I want a book that looks good because it's going to set the idea for me. I think Stieg Larsson's The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest is one of those that just has such a weird cover that you just want to look at it and you want to see what it says. And your eye just kind of stops on it. I think that's one of the reasons those books have done well. So you do have to balance it. You have to ask yourself, what am I going to do with it? With podcast novels, this is the general progression that I see. Really awful cover art will go up with the audio. Just really bad cover art. And after a while, the audience will start to get built up to the point that some audience member that will say, I'm going to do cover art for you because yours is bad. Or the person will realize, okay, it's worth doing. I now realize that I'm not wasting my time, that it's worth me either putting the money, the time, whatever it takes, into getting good cover art, especially when it goes to print. Because I mentioned before that a lot of people use podcasting as a way to get feedback and actually develop their novels, to get feedback from listeners and to, figure out what they need to change before it goes to print. So many times the podcast version is different from the print version, because they will learn things from the podcasting process that they apply before it goes to print. One of the reasons that this happens, and I don't know if this happens for any of you, but when I edit my work, I see what I think should be on the page. If I've just recently written it, I can look past the mistake every time because I know what's supposed to be there, but I'm not seeing what's actually on the page. Generally, I will set my manuscript aside for at least a month and then go back and read it again with a fresh eye. But another technique is to read it aloud. And that uses a different process in the brain and makes it a lot easier to catch those typos, because as you're trying to read it, you will stumble over the part where there's a word missing or the word's repeated or you've used the wrong word. It's a very effective form of self-editing. So you figure, if you're going to take the time to read the whole book aloud for the purpose of editing, it might not be a bad idea to go ahead and fire up a recorder, record that, and, that's a good way to get yourself into a lot of work. Because then you realize, oh, geez, now I have to go back and fix all my flubs, and I've got to...
That's the next question.
Yes.
What do you have to own? What kind of equipment do you have to own to do these audios or iPods?
Okay. One of the first things is you have to make the decision, how much do I want to invest? What is my goal? Okay. You can do it with as little as just a laptop. Laptops generally got a built-in microphone. You can sit there at that laptop, you can talk to that laptop and record it, and it will do moderately well. As far as the audio quality you produce, it's going to have a little bit of background noise, it's going to have some hiss, you don't want to touch it, you don't want to touch the table it's sitting on, because all of that will start to come through. And I know people that have done just that. However, it doesn't create the best audio experience, and when you have an iPod or something like that, you tend to have earbuds in your ear and you hear everything. So there are a number of challenges that you can solve in different ways. When I started, I was using a Mac laptop. I was using GarageBand to record my audio, and I bought a FireWire interface that allowed me to plug a professional microphone into the FireWire port of my MacBook and record the audio that way. And I got through the first audiobook using that method, and I don't know how I did because I almost went bald just pulling all of my hair out when it would crash and lose an hour's worth of audio. It was very, very frustrating. One of the reasons I had chosen to use the laptop was that it was quiet. Because that's one of the biggest challenges of recording audio, is to have a quiet environment where you don't have any of that fan noise. You can't hear your heater kicking on and off or your air conditioner kicking on and off. And, you know, for me, I live out in Rutherford County, up back away, so I don't have too much problem. A lot of people who live in the city, they'll have to record in their cars because our cars are the most soundproof environments we own, generally. And a lot of people will actually drive out to the country and record in their car because it's the only way they can get a clean recording. After fighting with recording directly to a computer for a while, I decided I wanted to make the additional investment to save myself the time to get a computerless recording setup, which is this device right here. That is a Samson H4N digital recorder, and it has ports on the bottom that you can't see, but that will allow you to plug a professional microphone into the bottom and record directly to that, either on batteries or on power. And it has no noise that it generates, and it records right to an SD card. So when I'm done, I just pull the card out, stick it in my laptop, pull the audio files off of it, and everything is nice and neat. One of the real advantages of this for me is today. Today, I wanted to be able to record the audio from this session, and I didn't want to have to bring my big microphone, and even if I had, that big microphone is meant for me to speak into it. It's not meant to hear you. But if you look at these microphones here, each one of these goes 120 degrees, so I have a good coverage of this whole room. Everybody will be able to hear your questions, and they'll be able to hear me speaking. So this served a number of purposes for me, because one of my outlets, one of the ways I've built up my platform, is to interview authors. I want to know what all these authors think, so it's a great way for me to sit down, pick their brain, record it, put it on the internet, and let all these other writers listen to it. And in a way, that's part of how I've established myself as an expert in podcasting and digital publishing. When I released my audiobook on Podiobooks.com, I got an email from Evo Terra, who originated Podiobooks.com, and said, hey, you know, you should go over and talk to the girls at PodioRacket.com. They have this show where they talk about new releases and new podcast authors, and they'll interview you. And I thought, well, hey, that's great. Anything to get the word out. So I went and I had a show with Rhonda and Heather over at Podio Racket, and we all had such a great time that afterwards they asked me if I would be a co-host. So I've been a host on Podio Racket for a little over a year now. It's been a blast. We did live shows for a long time on blogtalkradio.com, where we would do call-in. And one of the reasons I mentioned that is because you don't need that piece of equipment. All you need is a telephone. And it's like a recorded conference call that's then broadcast as an internet radio show. And Blog Talk Radio still has a program where you can go and create a half-hour radio show. They're once a week for free. You can interview people. You can do whatever you want with that half-hour audio slot. So previously we were doing one-hour shows, but Blog Talk Radio stopped allowing one-hour shows as part of the free service. And we've chosen not to pay for the service, so we're actually doing more pre-recorded interviews. And that's another reason I wanted to talk about this, is that Skype is free, and you can use it to talk to people all over the world for free from your computer. And there's a free piece of software called CallGraph that will record the call. And so it makes it very easy for me to do interviews with authors all over the world from my computer, record the call, edit it up, put it up on our website for people to listen to, and we get lots and lots and lots of listeners. Last week I interviewed an author in Bulgaria, another one in London. I've interviewed people in Scotland. You know, it's amazing. Time zones can be a little bit tricky. You know, I've had to stay up to the middle of the night to interview a few of these people, but, you know, it's just the fact that you have access to the whole world you can pick a relatively small slice of that world and still have a lot of media to cover. And I find that, again, that's that type of cooperative effort where I interview an author. I want to find out where their website is, what book they're working on. I want to tell all my fans about their book. And what are they going to do? They're going to go out and tell their fans about me. And it all starts to mushroom and compound upon itself. So did that answer your questions?
Okay. Thank you.
Now, because you were asking specifically about Amazon and about the Kindle, I need to take that conversation a little bit further. Because I hear a lot of people say, hey, I want to be on the Kindle. Well, being on the Kindle, you're attacking about 25% of the market. So, do you not want to be on the Barnes & Noble Nook? How about the Sony Reader?
Yeah.
How about the Kobo? And that's where you start looking at. One of the things that I'll make you aware of today is a site called Smashwords, which allows you to publish one time onto their platform, and they distribute to Barnes & Noble, Sony, Kobo, Apple, through the iBookstore on the iPad. They're working a deal with Amazon, but they don't support distributing to Amazon yet. So they are a good place if you're going to self-publish an ebook. They're a good distributor to go through if you don't want to have to go to each platform individually.
Right.
You know, which you can do with Barnes & Noble. You can go to the Barnes & Noble Pubit program, sign up for that, and publish directly onto Barnes & Noble.
Let you do it free?
Yes.
Free ebook. I want to do free ebook.
I have to check to see if Barnes & Noble will let you publish a free ebook directly through Pubit. I don't think it will. But Smashwords will allow you. Smashwords will allow you to make it free.
Yep.
And all the platforms that they distribute to downstream will accept it as a free ebook.
That's what I
want. And so that's what I've done.
And I had that same problem with the Amazon. That's
yes.
Because I wanted mine to be free.
Right, and what I've chosen to do, I didn't want to ignore Amazon, so I made it 99 cents.
Yeah.
That's as low a price as I could set on Amazon. I said, fine, I'm not going to ignore the market just because they won't let me make it free.
You're going to get that 25%. Yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, when you start looking at that, there's all these different areas, and my feeling is being as many as possible is a big benefit.
I think so.
There are getting to be more and more avenues for putting out, you know, apps for phones and all these different things. Don't ignore any of them because everyone can bring traffic to you. Like I said, that Nokia cell phone thing, I never saw it. Yeah, I just never would have thought it. The other thing you want to look at is what royalty are you going to be paid and for what price point? Because this has been a big change in the ebook publishing industry over the past couple of years is that the royalty structures have changed dramatically. Originally, most ebook platforms paid 35% of the retail price as your royalty, which I always thought wasn't enough. And when Apple came out with the iPad, they knew it was going to compete with Kindle, and they knew one of the ways that they could compete, and the same thing happened with Barnes & Noble, one of the ways that they could compete with Kindle is to draw the authors. And how do you draw the authors? You pay more royalty.
Mm-hmm.
So they decided, we're going to pay double that. We're going to pay 60%. We're going to pay 70%. We're going to pay 80%. So I think it's 60% from Apple and Barnes & Noble. Amazon raised theirs to 70% as long as you meet certain qualifications. The qualifications to qualify for 70% royalty on Amazon, you must price your book over $2.99. If you price it less than $2.99, you're back at the 35% rate. So for me, I'm selling it at 99 cents. I get 35 cents a copy. I'm at 35 cent royalty. I'm fine with that because it drives sales. But it's also nice that I've got the trilogy as a single unit for $2.99.
Right.
So when people do buy that, then I get 70% of that.
Yeah.
So that's a big difference between 35 cents and $2.10. But you have the flexibility to decide how you want to position yourself. One of the biggest mistakes I see people make with ebooks is overpricing them without building the audience first. If you overprice an ebook, you're not going to be able to build the audience because not enough people are going to want to take a risk to shell out that amount of cash on an author they don't know if they like yet.
I have another question.
Okay.
The ebook complier software. What is the best ebook complier software? If you just want to build yourself a website,
mm-hmm.
put your own ebook up there. Do you have a specific ebook compliance that's user friendly that you know of?
There are a few. One of them is called Calibre, C-A-L-I-B-R-E. It is a reader and has the ability to manage multiple ebooks. But I think the one that I use to actually modify my EPUBs, I'm trying to remember the name of it now. I'm sorry, the name of that particular software is escaping me, but I might think of it here in a moment. But there is a piece of software you can use to modify and create EPUBs. I'll go into the formats here in a minute. What I generally do, everything generally starts at a Word document.
Yeah, right.
Okay, which you can produce with OpenOffice, you can produce with right. Google Docs. You know, you don't have to have Microsoft Office to produce a Word document these right. days, which is good. But you do want to have that Microsoft Word document as the source so that when you go to Smashwords or Kindle or Pubit, it's going to expect you to upload a Word document.
Right.
Some of them will take PDFs, as if you had created a print-ready PDF for CreateSpace or some of the others. Some of them will ingest that PDF and figure it out, and others, I want the Word document.
Right.
So it's important to know that, because I've run into people who stopped updating their Word document with their edits and kept everything in the PDF that came back from their editor, and it was very difficult to take that formatted PDF and shove it back into ebook format. Because
yeah.
one of the things, the first things you learn about ebooks and how they differ from print books is in a print book, page one is page one. It starts at this word, it ends at this word, and it is fixed. But on an e-reader, you can change the font size. Well, if you change the font size, you've just changed the number of virtual pages. Mm-hmm. So pages are no longer pages.
And
so
table of contents are no longer table of contents.
Table of contents should no longer point to a page number.
Right.
They should point to a hyperlink to the beginning of that chapter.
That's right.
So that's a big difference in the way that ebooks are formatted and the way print books are formatted. When I work with authors that have already gone to print, they get really frustrated with me because I don't want the one they used to print it. That's already been laid out. It's got page numbers.
Yeah.
It's fixed. And many times the graphics are not just laid out as plain text. They're tableized, and they've got drop caps, and they've got graphics, and those things don't translate well into an ebook. So you're going to want to start with the Word document and a JPEG of your cover art. And
but
the JPEG
Amazon
should,
doesn't take PDFs.
I think they do, but they don't recommend it. It's not their preferred format. So
they're
what
HTML.
You do... They generate HTML.
Yeah,
yeah, the .mobi format, which they bought mobipocket.com.
It does too.
That's their format. Their format is .mobi.
.mobi.
Yeah, when Amazon wanted to create the Kindle, they didn't want to reinvent the ebook. So they went out looking for a company that had been successfully selling ebooks for years, and they found mobipocket.com, a French company.
Yeah.
They bought MobiPocket.
Yeah.
Used the .mobi format.
Oh yeah.
For the Kindle, so that's why the
so
Kindle
weird.
Uses this .mobi
so
format.
Weird.
And it's different. Most of your other ebook readers read what's called EPUB, which is also the Barnes & Noble Nook, the Kobo e-reader, Sony. Sony has its own LRF format, but it also reads EPUBs.
Yeah.
The EPUB is becoming the ubiquitous format for ebooks, with the exception of Amazon, and it's essentially HTML.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like a website. So you have that, you know, if you know web development, you are at an advantage
can't
when
you
producing
just put a website. Can't
no.
you just
and there's there are a lot of reasons for it.
Do
but
the page source copying page source?
It won't work. It won't work. So generally, you want to have that Word document to start from. That's going to be your cleanest source. Yes.
We in publishing the Foothills. Use Word documents, but we save them as plain text files.
Okay.
We used to copy and paste them in a notepad.
Yes.
To get rid of all the formatting. But now we can save it in a Word file as plain text.
Mm-hmm. One of the things, and that's a good point, because if you do go to publish with Smashwords, they want all that formatting stripped out. And one of the options you have is to take the text, copy it, dump it out to Notepad, which will blast all of the Word formatting out of it, create a new Word document, and dump the text back into it, and that will get rid of all the weirdness.
Be my
Yes, Notepad is
my friend.
It is your friend. What you want to be careful with is if you use a lot of italics or you use a lot of bold, just make sure it's being preserved.
Yeah.
Because there are ways to do it where it'll...
I'll just make it plain and simple.
And if you're a Mac user, the equivalent of Notepad is TextEdit. It does the same thing. Yes?
You got 1,000 books.
Yes.
Did they deliver them to your house?
They did not deliver them to my house. They delivered them to the old school building that's now storage units.
Yeah.
All right, because I live up a very long driveway, and I knew if they showed up at my house with a tractor trailer, there was going to be an issue. So I worked out a storage arrangement where they could drop them at the storage facility, and then I came and picked them up. And that's when I realized exactly how heavy 1,000 of these are. My back hurt for a week. They brought it on a shrink-wrapped pallet, cases of 20 books.
And who was your printing company?
I did... There's a multi-part answer to that question.
Oh, good.
I went through selfpublishing.com.
You don't do nothing simple, do
you? No, I don't. No,
you
I don't.
Went through what?
Nothing is simple.
You went
selfpublishing.com is a website that was put together by Ron Pramschufer, who's kind of a pundit in the publishing industry. If you look at selfpublishing.com, you can find his blog, and he has some really great information that can help you.
He's wonderful.
He is. He's a great guy, and I really appreciate it. All the information he had for me. And one of the things that distinguishes that site from other self-publishing sites is the ability for you to figure out what it would cost you to print X number of books using a specific technology at how many pages and figure out what your cost would be.
Woo-hoo.
So, for example, if you're going to get a print run done, if you're doing less than 500 copies, chances are you will not be using an offset press. You'll be using a digital press. And a digital press is kind of like a photocopier that prints your book out, does the binding, and one of the major differentiators between a digital press and an offset press is that a digital press uses pre-cut paper, which is a lot more expensive than big rolls of paper that go onto a Heidelberg press that get literally impressed with the old offset technology. So what I did was I did 1,000 units on an offset press, and because that paper was lower cost, and the fact that they're generating more units per impression on those large typeset presses. The saying in the publishing industry is the first book costs a fortune, the rest are cheap. Because when you go to put on a offset press, they literally typeset. Literally metal characters held together with lead. You know, it's work. And that's why when you go to press, if you're going on an offset press, you better not make any changes. You had best have your document finalized. Do not find an error when they've already typeset the document, because it's going to cost you money.
Did you have to buy your own ISBN?
I bought a block of ISBNs.
10 of them, right?
Yes, I bought 10 ISBNs. So, yes, you want to own your ISBN.
Right.
If you're going to self-publish, which may or may not be the best way for you to go, you'll want to own your own ISBNs. That way when somebody looks it up, it comes back to you. A lot of the self-publishing companies, it's not immediately obvious that you wouldn't own your ISBN and that you wouldn't get your rights back if it went out of print and all those sorts of things. So it's good to be aware of those things. So, yes, Bowker.com is the organization that manages the ISBNs, and you can buy a block of ISBNs. I bought 10 for $120. And ebooks also do take ISBNs and audiobooks.
That's the other question I forgot.
Yeah, I've chewed through almost all of my 10 ISBNs on my 4 titles. So that's something to keep in mind as well.
Yeah.
So, Karen, did you have another question?
I did. You've got Wolf Publishing, right?
Yes, White Wolf Publishing.
White Wolf Press.
Yes.
Now, you recently did a book for Laura Allen.
Yes. Yes, I've done 2 for Laura Allen. Essentially, what I do with White Wolf Press is, in general, I have targeted podcast novelists, because I know they're building an audience, and those with books already in print, because it relieved me of the editorial responsibility as a publisher of having to determine, has it been edited? If you've already got the book out in print, I was perfectly willing to pick up the ebook process. And, you know, I didn't want to have to be in a place where I was rejecting people. I'd already felt how that felt, and I didn't want to do it with anybody else. So I have never rejected anyone. I'm not a quality control person on the output as far as the quality of the writing. I am quality control as far as how does it look? Will it work on all the different readers? Can I get it out to all the different platforms? And what I offer through White Wolf Press is essentially an exclusive contract, which means I buy all the digital rights. I publish on all the digital platforms. The reason I do that is Amazon requires me to have exclusive digital rights. Technically, so does Smashwords. So you're supposed to have all the digital rights if you publish on them. But I offer a opt-out at any time for any reason clause. So that if an author says, hey, I've got a publisher who wants to pick this up, the rights automatically revert back to the author and they can take their book at any time they want. And I actually had that happen last week with Seth Harwood, who is a popular podcast novelist, had published a book with White Wolf Press, and then, you know, got to the point he said, you know, if I want to make the best of this, I need to learn how to do this myself. So my feeling on it was, great, I'll show you how to do it. Your books revert back to you. Here's your rights. Republish it. Off you go. Because my whole intention with White Wolf Press was just to help authors, to help myself and to help others out there who were trying to figure out to do the same things that I was doing. It was never really a profit-making venture for me. Although it has done well, that wasn't the motivation. So it's there. It's not something I push heavily because it's a lot of work for me. Because generally the most work for publishing an ebook is getting it to match Smashwords publishing guidelines. And they're just very specific. And if you've used Microsoft Word a lot, I'll give you an example of one of the differences. If you used a tab to create your first indent at the top of every paragraph, they don't want that. You have to take all the tabs out, and you have to use a little ruler bar up the top to create a more programmatical indent. Instead of using tabs, you use the little bars. You don't want curly quotes, you want the straight quotes. And you have to go in and turn off autocorrect in Word, because Word automatically puts the curly quotes in there, and you have to tell it, no, I really want the straight quotes. Because in HTML, they just show up as little squares.
Yeah.
So there's reasons behind all of it. You know, for every page break, you have to have two paragraph returns, either above it or below it, so that the formats that don't interpret page breaks don't just smush your chapters together. You want at least a couple carriage returns in between. So for every title that comes to me, if the author hasn't tried to format it themselves first, it's usually very easy for me. I could do it in half an hour and then publish it on all the platforms. I generally have an hour per title in, and I take 30% of the royalty paid to the author from the platform. So, as an example, if somebody's selling a title for $7.99 on Smashwords, where they're paying an 80% royalty, that means there's $6.40 due to the publisher. I would then take 30% of that, so just about $2, and the rest of it goes to the author. And I've felt that works relatively well. For me, most of the pain is when it comes to calculating royalties and cutting royalty checks. There's a lot of work involved. And also, my accountants just love the fact that I get all these little income streams from all these different places. That's just fun. I drive my wife nuts. So, where's this check from? India. Why do we get money from India? Don't worry about it. You know, and it's generally not in large enough amounts. Why am I getting $30 from India? But that's, you know, when I was looking for iPhone apps, it was a publisher in India that contacted me and said, hey, we're putting out iPhone apps, Android apps, iBook Store, and I'm working with them. I am still looking for another way, and I'm probably going to end up doing it myself, but that's just because I'm a geek. So, you know, if you have the technology skills to write Java code and compile it and do all that, do it yourself. That's my feeling. So, other questions? Anybody else have a question? All right.
Idea. Naturally speaking Dragon.
Yes, Dragon Naturally Speaking.
Thank you.
Yes, it's a speech-to-text, speech recognition piece of software.
Will it work for this?
Yes.
Okay.
What and then you can just do
Dragon something up?
Dragon Naturally Speaking.
Ah.
And then you can just add your hyperlinks.
Correct.
And when will this be uploaded?
This will actually be uploaded probably by tomorrow.
And we can find it?
You will be able to find it at brianrathbone.com. I believe we'll have a link from firesidebooksandgifts.com. Mm-hmm. And more than likely, it will air as a special episode on patioracket.com.
What did he say? What?
Dragon Naturally Speaking.
Okay.
And with Dragon Naturally Speaking, speech to text has never been. It will get close. It works best if you have a headset with a microphone that is omnidirectional and only expecting to listen to what's coming directly at it. Using this setup is worse because ambient noise, other things can corrupt or interfere with the process. Generally, when you're using speech-to-text, you train your computer to understand your accent, which is a very interesting process. I'll tell you this little side story. At one point, I used to race online using my computer. I was a NASCAR racer. And I raced in a league with all these other people, and we get out on the tracks. And I was really bad that when it came time that I had to pit, if I had to touch my keyboard, I would wreck somebody. And they didn't like me for that. So I tried to come up with a solution as a programmer, so I wrote what I called the voice-activated crew chief, where I could push a button on my steering wheel, and I could say, change my tires. And it would tell the game what to do, that way I didn't run anybody off the road while I was doing that. And a bunch of the guys I was racing with also wanted to use this technology, and so I made it available to them. But for all the Southerners, I had to go back and recode it to recognize TARS.
Instead of carry tone.
Exactly. So yeah. Generally, if you can set up your computer with Dragon Naturally Speaking, and you can spend time reading to it, where it knows what the words are and it learns how you say those words, that once you've trained it to a certain extent, you can dictate to your computer. And it will probably have 98% accuracy when you're doing that. So for people who hate to type, that's a way of doing it. There are people who record audio while they commute and then go back and transcribe it later. Whatever works for you. But yes, Dragon Naturally Speaking has come a long, long way from back in the mid-90s when it was introduced and I tried it and it couldn't understand a word I said. So it's absolutely a technology that's out there today and one that people can make use of if they don't like to type.
I was just thinking of the convenience for hosting a podcast.
Yes, and there are actually services out there on the internet which will provide transcriptions of audio recordings that will just do it for you. I know with Blog Talk Radio, that was one of the features that they came out with. When you did a Blog Talk Radio show, it would automatically produce a transcript of questionable accuracy.
They have it now where you could be a singer, and it actually, you can sing, and a lot of singers nowadays use it. Yeah. And it dubs and makes you have beautiful sounding voice when you really sing.
Indeed. And for, you know, for musicians, there's software out there that you can take your music and it will generate the sheet music. So, you know, there's a lot of things out there that can save you time these days. One of the things that I will say as a writer, I believe that every writer should definitely seek an editor before going to print, before going to ebook. If you're going to go out to ebook, consider it print. You're putting it out there. Don't put an unedited book out. Or if you do, you do so at your own risk. Yes?
I brought my best editor with me.
You did?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, there you go. Every writer should hug their editor. You know,
yes.
Because it makes a huge difference. You know, I work with an editor, and we do a two-read process for every book. She will read through my final draft where I've edited it to my fullest ability. I think it's perfect. And then I send it to my editor and she pulls it apart. But that's what her job is to, on that first read, there's plot points and continuity. And she'll just make a comment here or there. I want to know more about this. I want to know what that person is thinking. I'm really intrigued about this. Whatever happened to that guy? And I thought that was a woman, not a man. You know, when you start realizing you've made those types of mistakes, you go, oh, geez, how did I miss that? So I'll go through, and as an example, through one edit, Andrea made four comments, and I wrote an additional 9,000 words as the result of those four comments before I sent it back for the final edit, where just making sure I didn't shoot myself in the foot and make it worse, which I've done, you know. But I just feel it's impossible to edit your own work to the extent that it's ready for publication. So find somebody who's not a loved one, who doesn't really care about your feelings, it doesn't have a vested interest in your feelings. You know, if your brother's an editor, probably not the one to go to. You know, my brother personally would cut me down to size, but that's because he loves me and he's honest with me. But, you know, you want to work with somebody who understands the genre that you write in. I started working with an editor who worked in academia, and her expectations of what were on that page were very different from my current editor, who specializes in ending fantasy. And I have a much better time working with somebody who is in the genre, who that's what they're passionate about. They understand the reader's expectations and has helped me make my writing better. Not just error-free, but better writing. And that, to me, is where the real value of working with an editor is. If you can make me better, I'm happy to shell out a little bit of cash to make that happen. I will recoup that in the additional readers I get, because the fact that my books are not littered with errors and continuity errors and people changing gender and, you know, all kinds of things that I didn't intend when I wrote it. And I can tell you that myself, my wife, my friends, I've had dozens of people read my book before I sent it to the editor and they didn't catch it. But she has a method. And it's one of the things that, as a writer, can be a little difficult. Once you learn to read like an editor, it becomes difficult to read for pleasure. Mm-hmm. Because all of a sudden you start seeing all the mistakes, and you think, well, I wouldn't do that. I'd do that. I would have red X that one. This does not add to story. You know? I can't tell you how many times I saw the acronym DATS. Does not add to story. Whack it. You know, and that's another thing. You have to be willing at some point to let pieces of it go. And other pieces you might say, you know what, that's what I wanted, that's where I'm putting my stamp. But if you're going to do something like that and you're going to go against, you know, your editor's advice, just do it knowingly and do it for a good reason. Rules are meant to be broken, and if you're breaking them knowingly and for a good reason, chances are you'll be okay. But if you're just breaking them and not really being aware of it, somebody will call you on it. So that's my feeling just on editors. Whether it's ebooks, audiobooks, I think the only medium that is supportive of unedited works is podcasting. And that's because there's the understanding that it's part of the editing process sometimes, depending on how you present it to your readers. Some listeners, you know, some podcast authors will say this is a polished professional work. I know of one gentleman who spent six figures doing a full-blown audio drama, the music, the score, the directors, the producers, the whole spiel. And it is a professional piece of work, and it's tight, and you can tell. So there's an expectation level there. And they're also taking that and turning it into a monetized model. So the additional contents, that freemium thing, you know, they knew they were going to start charging for this content eventually. There are others who will say, you know what? I'm just trying to figure out what I'm doing. And I want to see if this is any good. So let me know what you think. And it creates a different expectation. So setting expectations with your audience is one of the things. Let them know where you are, and people will be supportive if you're honest about where you are and where you're trying to go. One thing I definitely want to make sure I talk about is Goodreads. As far as social networks, Twitter is a wonderful social network for connecting with readers, but it's hard to beat Goodreads when it comes to connecting with avid readers. Goodreads is a social network. When you go to Goodreads, what you can do is add every book you've ever read to your bookshelf. You can rate those books, you can read comments on those books, you can look at other people who have read the same books as you, and you can connect to people that way. The way that I use it as a writer is I listed all the books that inspired me to write fantasy. All the books that I enjoyed, and I rated them. The reason I did that is that when somebody comes and looks, And as a matter of fact, I took that and put a bookshelf widget on the About Me part of my webpage so that when somebody looks at the About Me, they can look at all the books that I've read. And if a fantasy reader says, you know what, I'm looking for a new author, they come to my website, they're looking at the About Me, and they see this bookshelf, and I say, here are all the books I've read that inspired me. If they like the same books that I like, chances are they'll like my work. So it's an opportunity to show people what inspired me. What I learned is that after I went through the painstaking process of putting a couple hundred books onto my shelf, was that there were other social networks similar to Goodreads, like Shelfari and Anobi and Library Thing, and they all served a similar type of purpose. And I thought, you know what, I want to be on all of them. But I sure didn't want to have to go back through and put those 200 books on each one of those shelves. So I found that Shelfari, nicely enough, has an export feature, which I can export my entire library. And I can generate from that just a list of ISBNs of all the books that I've read. And then I can import it to Library Thing and Goodreads and Nobi. So it saved me the process. I only had to do it once. But the reason that I talked specifically about Goodreads is it's just readers. Just readers, just writers. If you go to Library Things, there's a lot of librarians. It's always great to connect with librarians, people who just love books and want to work around books. But it creates a community. You can review other people's work. They can review your work. You can do giveaways. You can actually sell ebooks on Goodreads. I sell ebooks on Goodreads. I actually give away ebooks on Goodreads. And they do EPUBs. So you have the option to just upload your EPUBs. And you had asked earlier about the editor software, and I just want to touch on, when I'm creating an EPUB, I'll publish my book on Smashwords, and all the books on Smashwords are DRM free, and I'll explain what DRM is here in a minute, but I can download the EPUB that was generated by Smashwords. I can then open it up, I'm still trying to remember the name of that piece of software, and it's alluding to Sigil. S-I-G-I-L. That's the name of that piece of software. That is for editing EPUBs. And it is free.
Okay.
So I can open it up in Sigil, make some changes to it, and then I can upload it to Goodreads, or I can put it on my website if I want to sell the EPUB directly from my website. Because I think the EPUB, HTML, those formats are more preferable to most e-readers than PDF. Because PDF is generally rigid in its formatting. And you have to smoosh a page onto the screen, and then the text. You know, I actually put up the formatted PDF version of The Dawning of Power on my website and sold it through my website. And I quickly took it down because I sold it to three different people and they all said, it looks horrible. You know, as soon as it gets shrunk down, I had a fairly heavy font. You know, the font just looked huge and very thick. And it was hard for them to read. So I ended up posting an HTML version for one person and an EPUB for another person. They said, oh, that's it, perfect, everything's solved. And I thought, well, then I'm not going to sell that anymore because I'm just aggravating people. So I took the formatted PDF version down, and I just provide Kindle, EPUB. You know, on Smashwords, they actually provide a PDF, an RTF, a TXT. You can read it on anything. And that's one of the values that it provides is that the market for ebooks worldwide is actually larger than it is in the U.S. because in a lot of parts of the third world, cell phones are very popular. Books are almost impossible to get. So as third world countries are starting to adopt smartphones, they all have this reader that they're walking around with. And if you buy a smartphone, it's going to have an Android reader, or it's going to have a Kindle reader, a Barnes & Noble reader. You can download stuff from Smashwords. And so what we're finding is all over the world, people are adopting ebooks because they can't afford paper books. When I first started with ebooks, I was probably selling 85% of my ebooks were sold outside the United States. Argentina, New Zealand, Australia, South America, just all over the place. South Africa was one of the ones I saw recently. So, you know, there's a large market outside the United States, and when you tap that market, a U.S.-based publisher, you know, if you explain to them, look, 90% of the sales that I've made are outside of the U.S., then they realize you haven't already sold to the U.S. market. So there are a lot of different things that you can do with ebooks that you can't do with print books, and there's a lot of things you can do with audiobooks that you can't do with print books. My feeling is I want all three. I want to be on every ebook platform. I want to have a free piece of content to allow people to try my work with no risk whatsoever. I want a print version. I will probably, at some point, The Dawning of Power will go to print on demand as individual, the three individual books, instead of the three printed in one. I love this book. I'm really happy with the way that it came out. But I also realize that a $20 price point to enter into my work is probably a little higher than many people are willing to go. If I can come out with a $9.99 trade paper or mass market paperback type of form factor, I might have a better time getting into the print
market.
Who are
you going to choose for print on demand?
Currently, I've been encouraged to use CreateSpace by a number of others who have done that. I've got a company called Darkfire Press that I work with, who does layout work, cover art, internal layout, produce the print-ready PDF, get the barcode on the back of the cover.
Who is that?
Darkfire Productions.
Sounds good.
And their rates are very reasonable. And, you know, they do a good job on the print side. I never wanted to tackle the print side. That was more than I was willing to do as far as learning InDesign and doing a really well laid out. Print layout is really, it's an art. And it's generally worth paying somebody to apply their skills to it rather than butchering it yourself, because I'm really bad at it.
Have you ever heard of these coffee shops? Print.
Yes.
What is it called? It's called a
cafe press, I think, is what they're calling it. And it's essentially print on demand in a single machine. It's a small self-contained digital press. So if you get into the print on demand channel, somebody can walk into a bookstore, type in your book, it'll download it, print it, bind it, spit it out,
and
off
you
go.
Ching ching, you got the book.
And it's really interesting. I'll tell you my print-on-demand story, because this book is already, you know, I printed 1,000 copies of these, and one of the things I did was I started selling it on Amazon Advantage, and I gave them permission to cut up a copy and scan it and put it into the print-on-demand channel. And I didn't really know how it was going to go, and all of a sudden, one day I went on to Amazon and I started seeing new and used copies from alternate sources with a lower price than what I was selling my book for. Where are those coming from? Well, that was from the print-on-demand channel. So the first thing I did was call Fireside Books and say, hey, can you look up my book on your computer and see if it's in Ingram? And the answer I got was, yeah, it says they have 100 copies. Well, I hadn't had Ingram distribution up until that point. I just had a bunch of books sitting
great?
In my house.
You are so lucky.
Well, to a certain extent. There is a limited amount of benefit from being in a print-on-demand channel and not having returnability. Okay? The advantage is anybody can walk through that door, and even if I haven't sold books here on consignment, I don't have any books on the shelf, they can walk up to the counter and say, could you order me a copy of The Dawning of Power? They're going to look it up in the system. They're going to find out in Ingram. Ingram says they have 100. They're going to order a copy. And at that point, Ingram is going to print one and ship it. And just the one. They're not going to print 20. Chances are they're going to print the one. They didn't really have 100. They didn't have any. They just show that 100 to say, yeah, we've got plenty. Go ahead and order them. But the thing about it is, there's no reason for Fireside Books to stock that book. None whatsoever as far as
that's
what
true.
I'm offering them as an author, because it's non-returnable.
Yeah.
Okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So which means that if the buyer at Fireside Books says, buy me 50 copies of it, they're stuck with those 50 copies whether they sell or not. So a lot of print-on-demand companies are now offering returnability, which means the bookstore buyer can order the books. If they don't sell,
tear
they can
the
return, tear off the front cover, send the front covers back, pulp the rest, and get their money back. So there are people paying for this returnability service. Now, for me, I still think that offers a limited amount of value, because book buyers are not stupid. And they know, even though there's a returnability on that, when you look at a print-on-demand book, even if it has returnability, what are the odds that you're going to sell a lot of those books if the author is not somehow pushing them? So it's still a risky proposition. And I haven't met up with a single author yet who says, I went through print-on-demand, and I paid for distribution and returnability, and all the bookstores are stocking my book. I haven't heard that yet.
Yeah.
The only bookstores that I know that are stocking books that are sold through print-on-demand with returnability are chain stores where the author has set up book signings so that they have books to sell.
Yep.
So really, it's not buying you much. My opinion is, if you want to get on the bookstore shelves, you got to get a real publisher.
Yeah.
Otherwise, that's probably the last frontier.
Yep. And to get that real publisher, you have to have a lot of people to follow you.
Absolutely.
You have
well,
to make your own platform.
You have to build your own platform. You're going to have to, even if you sent out the first query letter to an agent and they said, I love your book, I found a publisher, you are still going to have to drive the sales to that book.
Yeah.
It actually works to get a book deal and not sell books than it was to not have the book deal to begin with. Because if you get the book deal and that publisher takes that risk, prints the books, send them out, and none of them sell, and all they get back are a bunch of front covers, they've lost money, and they're not going to forget that. So when you come back with your next book, they're going to say, why do I want to print your book? The last one cost us money.
Yeah.
You can essentially ruin your own writing career by having a bad first entry point into the publishing market. So be ready. And, you know, people have asked me, what is your greatest regret in the publishing that you've done? And it's that I wasn't building up my audience while I was writing the book, or even before I was writing the book. If I had started, I didn't have the structure in place on the day that that was released to create a buzz. It was released to a dull thud. Right? And that's probably what most people's releases would look like, because you don't have an audience. So it wasn't until after podcasting, freemium, being a radio host, doing all these things that put this media out, got my name out there, got my face out there, that I really felt I had any shot at a traditional publishing deal, at least one that would be good for me. It can be difficult, because writers can be solitary people who don't have that gene in them to stand up and say, hey,
we're
look
introverts,
at me,
we're
look
not
at me.
Extroverts, that's why we stand and write.
But
I wouldn't want to get out there.
Those who can get past it tend to do well, because they get the word out. You know, one of the things that I learned about Twitter, I'll go back to that again, is that I view Twitter as a writer's conference that's open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Some of the best contacts that I've made in the industry, I've made at writers' conferences. The World Fantasy Convention being my conference of choice, because it is specifically around speculative fiction, and it is the industry side. It's publishers, agents, writers meeting to make deals.
Yeah.
It's not, as opposed to, say, Dragon Con, which is a fan convention. Everybody dresses up and plays. It's great fun. I would love to go to Dragon Con and have a blast, but it's a different environment. I probably wouldn't go to Dragon Con to meet an agent and get a book deal. I would go to Dragon Con after I have an agent and a book deal to be shouty about my book. That's probably more the effect that I would take. But, you know, to have access to all these writer people all the time and to know that the writing community itself is extremely well represented on Twitter just makes it easier for to find the people who can help you get where you want to go. The publishing industry today offers several different opportunities. I don't want to be a self-published author alone. I want to be a self-published author and a published author. My feeling on it is self-publishing is more profitable if you have an audience. Traditional publishing is less profitable, but can help you build that audience by
giving you shelf
space in bookstores and putting resources behind you and legitimacy behind you that you didn't have as an independent self-published author alone. So my view is, for my personal journey, build up an audience, build up a reputation, build up a demand for your books with self-publishing. Don't charge a lot for them. Get a lot of numbers. Write my next book. Make it as good as I can. Then go out, find an agent, find a publisher. And instead of cold calling, because I've gone to these conventions, I now know agents. And I know writers who have agents. I've done favors for writers who have agents. So I have the ability to take an alternate route. I don't necessarily have to go through the slush pile. One of the best ways to get an agent is to have one of your writer buddies recommend you to their agent. That's one of the best ways, and one of the best ways to get your writer buddy to do that, because they're not going to do it unless you really have your stuff together, is to have your stuff together.
Yep.
And then, so that's kind of put it all together. And so I'm ready to go to the World Fantasy Convention in October of this year, manuscript in hand, friends lined
Wonderful.
Up, things all ready to go, so that I'm ready to go meet with the right people and try and go the traditional publishing route.
Yeah.
Even if I get that book deal, I absolutely will continue to self-publish other work, and I will use them to complement each other and share audiences and drive traffic to each other.
Yeah.
So it's all doable. There's nothing stopping anybody in this room from getting a book deal except for the gumption, talent, time, effort, but it can absolutely be done. And a lot of what I've found of this whole thing is about perception. Present yourself in the way you want to be seen, and understand that marketing is psychological. If you come off as an amateur, people will take you on your word for it. If you come off as a professional, people will take your word for it until you prove otherwise. So always present yourself as professionally as possible, even if it's just little things. You know, when I say go out and sign up for Goodreads and Twitter and Facebook, have a nice looking profile picture. Fill out all the data. Make sure you fill out the part that has your website, because if nothing else, that's search engine optimization, which I haven't touched a lot on because it's kind of technical, but essentially every high-ranking site that has a link points back to your website is a good thing for you showing up in Google results.
So link exchanging is a good thing.
Link exchanging is a good thing as long as the link you're exchanging... The term specifically link exchanging has fallen out of favor because it was generally a reciprocal. Hey, I'll put a link to your website on my page, and you put a link to my site on your page. And Google has discounted that to a certain extent. It's far more valuable to, say, have Goodreads.com point to your website. Amazon.com points to your website. Barnes & Noble. All these types of things are...
The bigger communities.
The bigger websites count as a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
A link from my website counts as 1% of a link from a higher-ranking website.
Yeah.
So just be conscious of the fact that every place you have a link back to your website is a good thing, even if it doesn't mean somebody has to click on that page. Google will see it and count it towards your page's overall ranking. How important is your website is determined by how many other important websites link to it. One of the things that I've found is my goal is to every week have something new come out. And so there's lots of people out there who do interviews. Some of them are radio show interviews, some of them are telephone calls, some of them are just, they'll send you a list of questions and you send them back a list of answers and they'll put it up on their website. And I generally have one of them coming out every week.
So that we want to keep up with you every week.
And not only that,
yeah.
But every one of those blog owners has a different audience.
Right.
So it's a way of, you know, if I'm just constantly going to my Facebook page and telling the same people the same thing, I'm never going to get any farther.
Right.
I have to expand my reach. I have to get out to those people who don't know me. And that's where search engine optimization comes in a lot, because I'll talk to people and I say, do you have a website? I say, yeah, I have a website. I said, well, have you done any search engine optimization? Can people find your website? Well, sure, if I go to Google and I type in my name, I'm the first one, so I'm done. Well, that's great for people that know your name and who are looking for you, but what about people who want to find you that don't know about you? How are they ever going to find you? Well, I realize if you search for fantasy author, fantasy book, free fantasy ebook, free fantasy audiobook, I want you to come to my website if you type that into Google. So I design my pages on my website to specifically target a term. My front page targets new fantasy fiction. And if I go to Google and I type in new fantasy fiction, we should see within the front page, there you go, I'm number 3.
There you are.
So that right there is the example of, you didn't have to know anything about me, but you had to search a term that's related to me that I've specifically made my website attractive to Google. And in doing so, I've used a tool called SEOmoz.org, which has a free tool which will examine a page and say, this page targets this term well.
What is it? S-E?
SEOmoz.org. And they actually have a tool that I can say, you know what? I've designed this page to target the term new fantasy fiction. Grade it. And they'll come back and say, you got an F. It's only on there once. It's not in this format. It's not H1, which if you're an HTML person, it's, it all comes down to website design. But it's not in the URL name. It's not in the first 100 words on the page. It's not bold. You know, though, all those little things. It doesn't appear in a link. It doesn't appear in an image name. So I know then at that point, well, if I put it in the URL so that my file name is newfantasyfiction.html, and I have a picture on that page that's called New Fantasy Fiction, Brian Rathbone's books, and I've used that word in the first 100, well, now all of a sudden I'm getting an A. Well, next thing you know, Google crawls my page, you type in New Fantasy Fiction, and I'm number 3. And again, off-page techniques. We talked before about me putting fantasy author in my Twitter profile. If I Google fantasy author, you'll see that number 4 is my Twitter profile. So I tried to target that keyword on my web page for years, and I could. I don't even know if I'm on the third or the fourth page. I mean, I have tried for a long. Oh, look at that! I've finally made progress. Fantasy author, writers, and professional on Twitter. That is the Twitter fantasy list.
There you go.
It has finally generated enough traction and enough links from other websites that I finally was able to target this, so, which means I'll probably go home and maybe change this to something else.
But freshen it up.
This actually works really well for me because when I go and I follow somebody on Twitter, they get an email that says, fantasy author Brian Rathbone has followed you. Now, as a fantasy fan, which generally I'm following fantasy fans, they usually go, what? Who's that? Oh, let me look at his profile. Hey, look at that. He's got a website. Let me check out his website. Oh, look at that. He's got free books. Next thing you know, I've got a reader. So it's all about using what you have available to free to your best ability. And Google is your friend. If you're saying, okay, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to design my website, and I want to know what term to target. What are people searching for? Google has a tool called Google Insights that I can go and I can type in new fantasy author, new fantasy fiction, fantasy books, fantasy author, and it'll tell me of those terms, this is the one people are most commonly searching for. Well, that's the one I want to target. So there are all these free tools out there that allow you to figure out what to target, how to target it, rate how well you've targeted, and then tell you how much traffic you're getting from it. Because I can go to Google Analytics and say, what terms have people been using to search for my website and coming to me? And I'll see fantasy authors on Twitter, you know, some really weird ones because I'm a programmer. You know, if you happen to type in putting barcodes in Crystal Reports, you'll find my site. But and that's another thing. Just use what you know. Use what you have to your advantage. I happen to have a lot of programming stuff, so I use that to draw people to my website. And it just happens that a lot of programmers are fantasy geeks, and it works. So sometimes getting creative really can work to your advantage because what are the limits? There aren't any. There aren't any. So, again, I will invite other authors to write blogs for my page. I'll write blogs for their page. We'll link back and forth. We'll talk about each other on Twitter. We'll talk about each other on Facebook. There's a lot of different things that you can do. So I know that we've gone a little bit beyond the time we had allotted. I'm available, and I don't want to chase anybody off. But I do want to make sure that I'm not going over my welcome. And see if we had any more questions based on what we've been talking about.
I'm going to go home and get your book on my Amazon Kindle.
There you go. That's a beautiful thing.
That's what I can do. Right?
That's a beautiful thing. Absolutely. Absolutely. You could do it right now. So thank you very much. I really appreciate everybody coming out. It's been a blast.